Good afternoon. Welcome to today's program sponsored by the World Affairs Council of Northern California and the Commonwealth Club of California. I am Gloria Duffy, CEO of the Commonwealth Club, and I'm your chair for this evening. We also welcome those joining us on radio for today's program. We invite all of our listeners to visit the World Affairs Council on the web at wacsf.org and the Commonwealth Club at commonwealthclub.org. Now it is my pleasure to introduce today's speaker. Richard Butler, native of Australia but citizen of the world, is a hero in the battle against the proliferation of nuclear weapons. The struggle to reduce, restrict, and as quickly as possible to eliminate large arsenals of nuclear weapons seemed to be meeting with success just a few years ago. The U.S. and Russia had committed themselves to START reductions, and several countries had given up their nuclear weapons or weapons programs. But once again today, we face a nuclear proliferation crisis threatening peace and security. India and Pakistan have tested weapons and added them to their arsenals. Iraq, Iran, and North Korea have incipient nuclear weapons programs, and U.S.-Russian reductions lag amidst talk of national missile defenses. Wherever proliferation has threatened in recent years, Richard Butler has been on the front lines, crafting policy not just to preserve the status quo or to prevent things from getting worse, but providing leadership for forward progress in restricting and reducing nuclear weapons. His most public role, you may have seen him many times on television, was as chair of UNSCOM, beginning in 1997. UNSCOM, as you know, is the United Nations Commission, which has monitored the Iraqi Weapons of Mass Destruction Program and inspected Iraqi facilities. Irrevocably committed to restraining Saddam Hussein's efforts to build the weapons, Ambassador Butler held the line against Iraqi weapons programs as long as he chaired UNSCOM. Disturbed by the lack of superpower progress in nuclear reductions, in 1995, Ambassador Butler chaired the Canberra Commission, which recommended a number of practical steps to constrain nuclear weapons. From 1992 to 1997, Ambassador Butler was the Ambassador of Australia to the United Nations. In that role, in 1996, he successfully led the deliberations of the UN to adopt the Comprehensive Nuclear Test Ban Treaty. In 1994, he chaired the Economic and Social Council of the United Nations. Ambassador Butler is now diplomat in residence at the Council on Foreign Relations in New York. Please join me in welcoming a distinguished leader in the field of peace and disarmament, Ambassador Richard Butler.
Gloria, thank you very much for that warm and generous introduction. I am honored to be here at the Commonwealth Club of California, and thank you to Jane for associating the World Affairs Council with this event. Before I go any further, I would want to invite the attention of all of you in this audience to the presence here with us today of Senator Alan Cranston. Having toiled in the vineyard of nuclear disarmament, among other forms of disarmament, but nuclear is my specialty for over a quarter of a century now, I'm utterly confident when I say to you that I think of no person who's done more persuasively or more passionately to promote the cause of nuclear disarmament than Alan Cranston. The book I've written is called The Greatest Threat, and I want to talk to you about it for about 24 minutes, looking at the clock up on the wall there, which would then leave us a good half hour for discussion. And I think it's very important that we do have plenty of time for questions and answers and discussion. The book I've written is called The Greatest Threat, Iraq, Weapons of Mass Destruction, and the Crisis of Global Security. And there's no better way for me to organize my remarks to you than around those concepts. So let me start with its title, The Greatest Threat. And I'll make two points about that. First, in the opening words of this book, a reality is stated that is inescapable. Those words are that the greatest threat to human life are weapons of mass destruction, nuclear, chemical, and biological. I go on to point out that these things don't exist in nature, they don't grow on trees, but these weapons have been created as a consequence of the science and engineering so brilliantly invented by human beings, which has also been made available to constructive purposes in medicine and in other ways, but has produced weapons which now, sadly, pose the greatest threat to all human life. Excuse me. I also make the point that these weapons have been recognised as the greatest threat and have been the subject of the weaving of a tapestry of treaties amongst the nations of the world in the last 40 years, which rests on the idea, on the recognition that these weapons are unique in their destructive capability and that therefore no one should have them, and then proceeds to make political commitments in the form of treaties against their manufacture, use or proliferation, and indeed sets up arrangements under which we can inspect and verify and see whether or not the commitments that states, countries have entered into are being kept. I also make clear that in today's circumstances, those treaties have been threatened by Iraq. And that's the second part of the title of my book. One word, quite simply, Iraq. Now, the point that I'm making here is that what we saw revealed at the end of the United Nations operation to remove Iraq from Kuwait when it invaded Kuwait in 1990 was that Saddam Hussein had created a fairly awesome array of weapons of mass destruction. He was at work in making a nuclear explosive device, and we discovered that he was only 6 months away from acquiring that. But he had created a quite substantial arsenal of chemical weapons and of biological weapons, and had acquired a long-range missile capability with which to deliver those weapons. And what was absolutely central to this activity was that he had done that even though he had fundamentally agreed to the treaties that form the tapestry that I referred to a moment ago. Quite specifically, Iraq is a party to the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. Yet shortly after it joined that treaty, Saddam instructed privately, secretly, that his scientists should proceed to make a nuclear weapon. Iraq is bound by the Convention on Chemical Weapons, the 1925 Convention, and the decisions of the Security Council on chemical weapons, even though it's not signed the modern convention. Iraq is bound by the Biological Weapons Convention, yet in each of these cases, they made the weapons that were banned by those laws that form a part of the tapestry of treaties. And in the case of chemical weapons, had actually used them, first within Iraq on his political opponents and secondly against Iran in the mid-80s in the Iran-Iraq war. Now, what that behaviour represented was the fulfilment of everyone's worst nightmare. I have spent over a quarter of a century on the business of helping negotiate those treaties, as has Alan Cranston, of helping to bring into existence a body of international law, and I want to emphasise this to you, a body of international law made under the system that we created at the end of the Second World War, the United Nations system, the hallmark of which was that international relations would increasingly be regulated by law. Under that system, we meticulously and carefully negotiated a series of treaties that, which would quite simply make these weapons of mass destruction inadmissible in civilized society, and would seek to ensure, give countries the opportunity to join up with such treaties and then seek to ensure that they were obeyed. The worst nightmare of all treaty partners in those contexts is that someone will cheat from within. And this is a very, very simple idea, but it is what the words suggest, that a country would sign up to these obligations but then abuse them and cheat from within. That's a much more important concern than the situation where a country has declined to join a treaty and has gone ahead and made some of the weapons involved. And there are three of those in the nuclear area today, and they're Israel, India and Pakistan. And what they have done is a matter of grave concern. But at least the one thing they've not done is cheated from within. They didn't join up and then cheat. But Iraq did. Iraq, in our lifetime, is the paradigm case of everyone's worst nightmare. And that is why the other subheading of my book is A Crisis of Global Security. Because the circumstances that we have come to have on our hands are these. Iraq signed the treaties, then proceeded to cheat on them. Then it invaded Kuwait, and the UN was able to agree that it should be expelled from Kuwait, and that gave us an opportunity to bring its weapons under control through disarmament. But Iraq refused to allow that work to be done completely, and by that action has both challenged the authority of the supreme lawgiver in this field, which is the Security Council, and jeopardised the fabric, the tapestry, the fabric of the treaties on the non-proliferation of weapons of mass destruction. Putting it at its simplest, if Iraq is able to get away with this, then the possibility that other states will both lose faith in those treaties and the willingness of the large powers to enforce them, and maybe take decisions to themselves, do what Iraq has done, which is either leave the treaties or cheat on them and make weapons of mass destruction. And I don't know any other word with which to describe those circumstances other than crisis. I consider that to be adequately described as a crisis in the management of global security, because major commitments, the treaties, involving major subjects, weapons of mass destruction, which are the greatest threat to all of us, and finally, the authority of the supreme lawmaker and law enforcer in this field, namely the Security Council, has been challenged by Saddam Hussein, and it would seem, possibly, successfully. Now, what I've done in this first part of my remarks, working through the title of my book, is to seek to describe to you what is at issue, how large it is, how important it is. But let me tell you briefly how we got there, and then what I think we might do about it. How we got there was that 2 years ago, when the world was becoming tired, quite properly so, of recurrent Iraqi crises, and even more properly, when the world was becoming alarmed at the length of time for which sanctions had been applied to ordinary Iraqi people and the consequences of those sanctions, I took a step which was unprecedented. It was slightly dangerous. It had to be very carefully calculated. But I did it with great care and on the basis of outstanding scientific advice. And that step was that I went to Baghdad with a list of final disarmament requirements. We had been able to disarm Iraq of a good portion of its missile capability, a fairly good portion of its chemical weapons capability. We'd put the nuclear program on hold. We'd got nowhere with biology, by the way. I have to tell you frankly, they lied comprehensively to us about their biological program. But I took a step in the middle of 1998 because I had a sense that time was running out on several fronts, politically and for the Iraqi people. I took the step of going to Baghdad and giving to Tariq Aziz, the man that Saddam had deputized to deal with me, giving him a final short list of what I call priority disarmament requirements. I made clear to him that these were the necessary conditions if I were to be in a position to tell the Security Council that Iraq was disarmed. Whether or not they would prove to be the sufficient conditions would depend on the quality of Iraq's cooperation and answers. But I went there and I gave them this list. I called it the roadmap, the final roadmap. And it had, in the missile area, four requirements that needed to be met, materials that needed to be given to us. In the chemical weapons area also, there were sort of four areas of materials and equipment and documents that needed to be given to us. And in the biological area, it was a top-to-bottom review that was needed. In June 1998, Tariq Aziz said, a little with some complaints, he said that I'll work with that list. Come back here in August and we'll see if we can settle it. So I went away and I put into action an intense program of inspection and work, etc., from my own people to try to make all this happen. And I did indeed go back on the 6th of August, in the beginning of August 1998, knowing very well what had and hadn't happened. And on the 3rd of August 1998, in the conference room of the Foreign Ministry of Iraq in Baghdad, Mr. Tariq Aziz said to me, "You begin the meeting. You tell us what has happened in the last 6 weeks." And I said, "Well, fine, I'll do that." And I went through each weapons area and said basically that nothing had happened, that almost everything on the list that I'd given them, the roadmap, had not been completed. We needed some missile fuel, we needed some chemical shells, we needed a different account of their biology program, and none of it had been presented. And indeed, in the meantime, we'd actually discovered ourselves some more information that was very disturbing. But I have to be economical with our time and I won't go into that. But I said to him that sadly, I'd given you this list, which was Iraq's way out of jail, as it were. And I said, "My report to you, Mr. Deputy Prime Minister, is that you've given us basically nothing." And he said, "Well, I thought you would say that." And I thought, well, you don't have to be Sherlock Holmes to work that out because, you know, we knew that these were the facts. And he said, "Come back tonight at 8 o'clock and I will give you the answer of the leadership of the government of Iraq." And again, you don't have to be Sherlock Holmes to work out who that is. And I said, "Okay." And we came back at 8 o'clock at night. And he said, "Now you listen to me." He said, "Iraq is disarmed. We have no more weapons of mass destruction. The materials that you ask for do not exist. We will give you no more materials or documents or access to buildings. it's finished. Your duty is to go back to New York now and tell the Security Council that Iraq is disarmed and demand our relief from sanctions. And he said, if you do not do this, this will be on your conscience. So I said to him, more or less straight away across the table, very carefully, don't know where I got the presence of mind from to do it, but it was dead right, if I may say so. That's not boasting. It was economical, but it's what needed to be said. And I just said to him very carefully these things, and it's in the book. I said, I will not do what you've asked me to do because I cannot do it. I cannot do disarmament by declaration. You have refused to give me the evidence that would enable me to do what you demand. And therefore, I cannot do it, and I will not do it. I said, and by the way, thank you for your kind concern about my conscience, but I assure you I'll sleep easily in my bed tonight. And he said, well, you're out of here, you're finished. And the next day I went back to my bedroom, my place of dwelling in Baghdad, which is a whole other story. But I went back there and I called the Secretary General of the United Nations, the President of the Security Council, on our satellite telephone that we had our own stuff, and said, it seems that this is all over. And called up our aircraft, got it up from Bahrain the next morning and left and went to New York, where I duly reported these facts to the Security Council. Now, what's really interesting about those events is actually three things. One, they indicated that the list, the roadmap, was right. That if Iraq had agreed and given me the things that were on that list, we would have actually disarmed them. And they refused to because, consistent with Saddam's position through the whole 9-year period, he would do anything to retain his weapons of mass destruction capability, including continue to subject the poor Iraqi people to sanctions. Had the list not been right, had it been made up of peripheral things, things that were easy for him to give, then they would have given them to us. So the first thing is the list was right. The second thing is that their ability to shut us down rested on their firm knowledge that they would be supported in the Security Council by the Russians. And on that too, they were absolutely right. And as a consequence, they felt confident that they could throw us out and not be particularly harmed. I said three things, but there were two. They were the two main points. Now, the third thing is this. What that has meant is that since that time, which is almost 2 years, there has been no effective arms control or monitoring of Saddam and Iraq's weapons of mass destruction programs. What that has meant is something of which we can't be completely certain, because if you're not there, you can't see, and that's the whole point about having a presence. But I want to tell you that I am satisfied from evidence that I have seen that he has recalled his nuclear design team. He has begun a program of extending the range of his missiles and is back in business in the chemical and biological warfare fields. Now, as we're heading towards 6:30, let me move to the last set of issues, which is, what do we do about this? Recall, what is at issue here? A person who is clearly addicted to weapons of mass destruction, a person whose track record is second only to that of Hitler, because he has used chemical weapons for genocidal purposes. A person against whom the whole authority of the major post-World War II mechanism for the maintenance of international security and peace was invoked, the Security Council. And in the face of that authority, he has said, I will not obey you and I don't care what you do with me. So all that's a crisis in the management of global security. All of those are the things that are at issue. And finally, he's back in business because he's been free of regulation for 2 years, and he became free of that regulation, and this is what is the clue to the future. He became free of that regulation essentially because he knew that the permanent members of the Security Council were divided on the issue, quite specifically that Russia would support him. So what I recommend in my book is the following: that there must be an agreement amongst the permanent members of the Security Council that they will always act together to protect and enforce the non-proliferation treaties, the nuclear, chemical, and biological weapons treaties. That whenever a credible report of the infraction of one of those treaties is received, that there'll be no vetoes, there'll be no client statism, but they will stand together and make clear to the offending state that they should stop and desist from what they're doing and disassemble what they were making, and if they do not, it will be physically removed under the authority of the permanent five members of the Security Council. Now, what I call that in my book is the principle of the exception, that we must, at the beginning of the 21st century, make an exception from politics as usual for weapons of mass destruction. Because they are so uniquely threatening to us all, they should not form any part of the usual business of political negotiation, the canvas for which is immensely rich and detailed. It's like a Jackson Pollock painting, with world trade and cultural relations and whose friend is whose and so on. There are a zillion things that the countries of this world can either cooperate on or compete on and so on. But I say that weapons of mass destruction should not be one of them. That they should fulfill their responsibility for keeping the treaties whole. That they should give the world a guarantee that whenever these treaties are breached, that they will stand shoulder to shoulder and deal with it. They should make an exception for weapons of mass destruction because they are so uniquely dangerous. I do not for a moment believe that what I'm proposing is hopelessly idealistic. On the contrary, and I discuss that in my book, on the contrary, I think this is quintessential realism, because these weapons are worse than useless and they're dangerous. And they complicate all the other political negotiations that normally take place. And that their removal, taking them off the chessboard, taking this piece away, corralling them, making them the subject of separate and determined control and enforcement by the world community, would deal with the problem that they pose and would actually serve the interests of all, including those who hold permanent seats on the Security Council. I think it's a fundamentally sound and realistic proposal. It is above all the dividend that we should have brought home already, but it's not too late, from the end of the Cold War, the hallmarks of which were an arms race, the threat of mutual assured destruction, and client statism. And now that that Cold War is over, that competition has ended, it seems to me that the real application of the doctrine of deterrence, which has now become available to us, is not amongst these big powers and their nuclear weapons, which they are committed by their own statements to remove, but the real opportunity now for the constructive application of a doctrine of deterrence is to deter those few states that from time to time will arise, rogue states, that will seek to break the rules on chemical, biological and nuclear weapons. The best application in the future of a post-Cold War doctrine of deterrence would be the large powers standing together and saying to any rogue who seeks to break these civilized principles that you will not be permitted to do it, and if so, you'll have to deal with us. Thank you for your kind attention.
Thank you, Ambassador Richard Butler. I have a number of questions here relating to your experience in Iraq and your book, The Greatest Threat. Let me begin with a reference to your remarks with respect to the UN Security Council's need to step away from business as usual. Several of the questions asked whether you got support from the United Nations Security Council and whether you believe that Iraq's neighbors were supported you in your work on behalf of the UN.
The United Nations Special Commission, the one that I headed and before me Rolf Acaus headed, charged with disarming Iraq of its weapons of mass destruction, went through two phases. The earlier phase, when the permanent members of the Council supported the work, resulted in significant disarmament of Iraq. The latter phase, which began shortly before I took up the job, but then increased when it became clear to Iraq that I was not prepared to cook the books, the latter phase was marked by a dispute amongst the permanent members, and when that took place, Iraq stopped getting disarmed. And it's actually as simple as that. You can divide it into two periods. As far as the neighbours are concerned, the same is true by extension. When there was unanimity in the world community about the need to get this job done, Kuwait, Bahrain, Saudi Arabia and so on were on board. The minute that unanimity became shaky, then they had to go back to a more traditional kind of politics of looking at their neighbour, for whom they have no affection, namely Iraq, and trying to work out how to live with someone that was a real problem in the neighbourhood, but with respect to which the wider international community was starting to give up. And so their support for us also started to ebb away for reasons that I think were entirely understandable.
Ambassador Butler, what do you think Saddam Hussein is up to with regard to weapons of mass destruction? And specifically, where exactly do you believe Iraq is with respect to its nuclear weapons program?
The last technical conversation I had in Baghdad during my last visit there, and I did mainly policy conversations, but I'm not ignorant of the technical stuff, and I had superb advisors. Isn't one of the presidential candidates making that latter point these days? About having superb advisors? That was a joke, you know. Anyway, are you allowed to joke on the radio? I suppose so. The last technical conversation I had in Baghdad was actually about missiles. I spoke at my request with the general in charge of Iraq's missile program and told him that they were conducting experiments to increase the range of their missiles that was illegal and they should stop. And he said he didn't agree that it was illegal, which was nonsense. But more importantly, he said they didn't propose to stop. So because of that, and because of reports I've seen subsequently that they've been seeking to acquire materials needed to make their missile force fly longer, I don't have any doubt that they're back in the business of making long-range missiles, which are, for them, illegal. Now, missiles are only vehicles. They carry something, whether it's a normal explosive or a nuclear, chemical, biological warhead, whatever. So the real focus of attention then shifts to, well, what warheads would these missiles carry? Obviously, conventional explosive is always a possibility. Or cement. Do you know that they once fired a missile at the Israeli nuclear reactor, in the warhead of which they'd simply put cement? Because if coming out of ballistic trajectory, it had gone into the core of that reactor, it would have demolished it just because of the sheer weight and velocity of the thing involved. But let me come more quickly to the point. On nuclear, all they lack is the special fissionable material to make the core of the bomb. They know how to make it. They're well advanced at doing that. If they have acquired that material, presumably on the black market, if they acquired that material tomorrow, 10 kilograms of plutonium or highly enriched uranium, they would be able to detonate a device in 1 year. That's the simple answer to that question. On the other two, chemical and biological, I don't know what the orders of magnitude are because we're not there anymore, but it can be beyond doubt that they're back in the business of making those substances again.
What is the risk that Iraq will acquire the highly enriched uranium or plutonium they need as a result of the breakup of the former Soviet Union?
High risk. And that's driven by two things. One, because of that breakup and because of the poverty of people in the scientific community in Russia and with access to those materials who may want to get themselves out of those problems by selling some. And some of those materials have already appeared in black markets in the Middle East and in southern Germany, actually. But the other thing that drives that possibility is that Iraq doesn't have any supplies, indigenous supplies of uranium of any quality, which drives them towards black market acquisition of fissile material. In stark contrast, for example, to my country of origin, where a third of the world's uranium lies in Australian soil, and you can dig it out of mountains there, and it's almost 100% pure. Iraq has none. And its past attempts to get enriched uranium were through the method of digging up phosphate, of which they do have some, and then taking the minuscule amounts of uranium that occur in nature within phosphate rock, taking it out atom by atom. It's very laborious and very difficult and not particularly productive. So that drives them, I think, towards looking to a black market acquisition where they would pay some disaffected scientists tens of millions of dollars to hand over the required material.
From the technical to the political, did President Bush wimp out in the Gulf War? Should he have forced Saddam out of power or even perhaps turned him over to the opposition?
No. The past President Bush, that was another joke. No, President George Herbert Walker Bush did what he had to do, which was to deliver on the mandate given by the Security Council to expel Iraq from Kuwait and to go no further. Had he gone further, it's almost inevitable, I think, that the coalition of countries that participated in that operation would have flown apart. Had he gone further, without a mandate to change the government in Baghdad, it would have been in violation of the Charter of the UN, which says that you don't interfere in the domestic affairs of member states. And as far as the opposition is concerned, I think then it wouldn't have been clear to whom government would have been handed over, and would that have been any better than Saddam? So under those legal and political realities and the imponderables of what would have replaced him, I think George Bush took the right decision. What I hear frequently, and this question gives expression to, is deep regret that it wasn't possible then to change the government in Baghdad. And, of course, one can readily agree to that because of all the cost and suffering that has taken place subsequently. And I think there can be no doubt that the situation is unlikely to change until there's a better government in Baghdad. But how to get from where we are today to that point is an enormous problem. President George Bush's handling of it in 1991, I think, was appropriate.
Please comment on the proposed national missile defense, its viability, and its relevance to the threat posed by Iraq.
The proposal for national missile defense, as articulated now, is the wrong answer to the right question. The right question is, what do we do about rogue states like Saddam's Iraq? To propose to build a missile shield against them under circumstances where, one, they don't yet have the weapons that it is said it would defend against, and we don't know any time soon whether they will or not. Two, it is a shield the viability of which is doubtful. Three, it will inevitably cause first China and then Russia to build new weapons to pierce that shield. And four, it embeds in the system continued reliance on nuclear weapons, which is precisely what the United States and the other nuclear weapon states last month in New York promised to remove. Under Article 6 of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, they promised to continue the process of safe nuclear disarmament. To sum that up, I cannot agree, in fact, I robustly disagree with a counter-proliferation measure against a perceived possible act of proliferation. Does that sound like too much jargon? The postulant that these countries have been named by the proponents of national missile defense. The postulation that North Korea, Iran, and Iraq will shortly be able to threaten the United States with nuclear missiles, you know, is to say that proliferation is about to take place. National missile defense is an answer that involves counter-proliferation to match it by other weapon systems, rather than an answer which seeks to cut off the offending proliferation at its source. And that's what I would prefer, because the action of counter-proliferation will start another arms race. And all this around a shield that, if it works briefly as a flicker in an eye, will be quickly pierced by further weapons development. It makes no sense. The right question is being posed: what to do about proliferating or rogue states? That's what my book is about. Saddam has been the paradigm case of this in the back end of the 20th century, the century in which we wove that tapestry of treaties. You see my point? And that he might get away with this is a crisis in global security. But the answer to it is not to build more weapons. The answer is to cut off proliferation at its source, is for the great powers to stand together and say this will not be permitted to happen, if necessarily by military means, and is to shore up the non-proliferation treaties by beginning with ourselves, by fulfilling our commitments to nuclear, chemical, and biological disarmament, to make those regimes strong. I do not believe for a moment that this horse, North Korea, Iran, and Iraq, has left the stable and is halfway up the hill. I don't believe it. It's nowhere near over the hill. It's not even halfway up the hill. It is not too late for us to take non-proliferation steps rather than the incredibly dangerous step of counter-proliferation and unleash another round in the arms race. Now, I know I've spoken strongly about that. I've done so because I think it is crucial. And And I'm well aware that this is being broadcast, and I'm going to say one more thing about it. I am shocked at the way in which debate on this has been moving in an election year. It almost seems as if it's impossible for candidate Gore, for example, to say, not so fast. I don't agree. I want to think about this further. I want to look at non-proliferation measures before I would agree to counter-proliferation measures. Because this deeply serious subject has been made a part of good old muscularity. That candidate Bush has said, my God, we're going to have defence on all 50 states, whatever the hell that means. And he's therefore, you know, it's not he personally, but it started to be removed from the region of what I would call rational debate, because it's been put into campaign 2000 in a way where the challenge is the patriotic one. Are you going to stand up and defend us or not? Can we expect that of you as president? Where are your muscles? Ladies and gentlemen, we have to be better than that. This is the strongest country that history has ever seen. And that doesn't necessarily translate well into unilateral muscularity. What about taking that strength to the Russians, the French, the Chinese, and say, join with us in a major effort to prevent proliferation, which is very different from saying, be quiet and accept, which is what is being said to the Europeans, to the Russians, the Chinese, be quiet and accept that we are determined to do this for ourselves. Against what? An Iraqi missile, one or two of them, which may or may not occur, long-range missiles with nuclear warheads. I mean, it makes no sense. It's the wrong answer to the right question.
Speaking of U.S. government actions, next questioner asks, how much is the United States responsible for Iraq's weapons capability, both from our support from the support for Iraq during the Iran-Iraq war and by commercial actors within the United States?
I don't know the exact order of magnitude, but it is the sorry fact that a number of countries that subsequently opposed Iraq after it invaded Kuwait had previously contributed to its weapons capability, and the United States was one of them. But certainly in my visits to Iraq, I was acutely aware of the omnipresence, wherever I went, of helicopters, tanks, guns and aircraft and so on, which were fundamentally of Soviet and to some extent French origin. And I do know that China made a big contribution to their missile program, and I think they were more significant suppliers than, say, the United States or the United Kingdom.
Do the major nuclear weapons states, such as the United States, have a credibility gap on nuclear nonproliferation since they have not moved toward the elimination of nuclear weapons?
Really simple answer to that question is yes. And it's why what happened in New York at the end of May was so important. At the conference on the review of the Treaty on the Nonproliferation of Nuclear Weapons, there was a showdown, and the nuclear weapons states did concede that they had to do better in advancing nuclear disarmament if it were to be reasonable for them to expect that other countries would not seek to acquire nuclear weapons. And that was a very significant development. This is very hard for people here at home in the United States to understand. I say at home because I'm now a permanent resident of the United States, but this is very hard for people to understand. But I beg of people to understand these things. There's something fundamentally iniquitous for people in the United States to say our security requires nuclear weapons but then to say to 180 other countries, starting with India and Pakistan and so on, that your security does not. That is not credible. Now, and that's a problem. And there is also what I call the axioms of proliferation, and they are these, which is that as long as any country has nuclear weapons, others will seek to acquire them. There's no other possible outcome. And the second axiom is that as long as nuclear weapons exist, they will be used, either by accident or design. And these two feed each other, you see. If any countries have nuclear weapons, others will seek to acquire them, and there therefore will be proliferation. And we're seeing it now. India, Pakistan, Korea, North Korea put its toe in the water, taken out for the time being. Iran, Iraq. Israel has been a clandestine nuclear weapons state for 20 years. The pressures are there. And as proliferation proceeds, remember the axiom? As long as any country has them, others will seek to acquire them because of that iniquity I mentioned. People just won't swallow that you can have them for your security, but we can't have them for ours. So it will occur. And the more that occurs, the more likely it is that by accident or design, one day these weapons will be used. What that seems to me to suggest in rather riveting logic is that we've got to stay on the track of nuclear disarmament. It doesn't mean we strip ourselves naked, but balanced, careful, verifiable, safe nuclear disarmament, ultimately one day, which is exactly what the nuclear weapon states committed themselves to in New York a month ago, one day would lead to their elimination.
If Iraq deserves a UN inspection team, what other nations should have inspection teams?
Well, the fact is that the overwhelming number of nations in the world do, under the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty and now under the new Chemical Weapons Convention. I used to say to the Iraqis in Baghdad, you think you're being singled out for special treatment? They'd say, you bet. And I'd say, well, you're right. You are, because you invaded Kuwait and because we got to understand that you'd made an awful quantity and quality of these weapons. And so you are, yes. But it's temporary. I said to Tariq Aziz once, what I'd like to see you become is a normal country, where you have normal routine inspections from the International Atomic Energy Agency, from the Chemical Weapons Convention, like we all do, and that those inspections routinely show no violation, and we all have a happy life. That's norm. That's the norm. That's normal. Our inspections of the world's chemical industry will be a permanent feature of our life, because that industry can so easily be turned to chemical weapons or make wonderful products for all of us in medicine and materials, fabrication and so on. But there will be inspection of it to see that it's not producing chemical weapons. And that will be a fact of life. But so what else is new? Airports are inspected all the time by the Federal Aviation Authorities, the International Civil Aviation Organization, to see that safety is being maintained. Look at the Food and Drug Administration. Maybe it's too heavy. But, you know, the whole business of pharmaceuticals, when you think of it, they're very dangerous substances. But they're regulated through prescriptions and inspections and quality controls and so on. And on the whole, those dangerous substances are used to our good. And that's what's going to happen in the modern world. And that's normal. What is not normal is what Saddam was doing, which was trying to cheat on all of that. And that's what I put to them. So the answer to your question is, yes, other countries should be inspected, but hopefully in a properly organised world with real great power commitment to keep these treaties whole, everyone would be inspected. But everyone would get clean bills of health.
I have a number of questions regarding the efficacy of sanctions, so let me just ask you two. Do you think that the sanctions are counterproductive to the extent that the sanctions strengthen Saddam Hussein with the Iraqi people by consolidating economic power in the regime? And secondly, are you willing to go on record as supporting lifting the economic sanctions on Iraq?
You saved the easy ones to last, huh? Sanctions are a respectable means of trying to get compliance with the law without going to war. It's a non-military means of trying to get people to recalcitrant states to obey the law. What we now know from the Iraq experience, though, is that if they go on for a long time under an immoral and ruthless regime, then all that happens is that their burden gets transferred to the ordinary people, a black market gets created that the regime prospers from, and as the questioner suggested, they're parlayed into a reason why you should stick with the regime to defend against these foreign devils who are putting sanctions on you. So it's all become rather counterproductive. This is a major part of what I call the crisis of global security. The UN has really got to get its act together in working out how to do sanctions better in the future, because this does, the way it's going now is it's hitting the wrong people and it's not it just doesn't work. The answer probably lies in what are called targeted sanctions. Saddam Hussein, for example, is reported to be the sixth richest man in the world. Well, target his bank accounts in Switzerland, not the ordinary people. So, you know, that would be one way to go. Now, it's easy for me to say, to the UN's credit, it is now urgently studying this matter, and we have to find a way, I think, to do it differently in the future. I've saved the hardest one, Jane, to last, which is, should they be lifted now? I have to be careful of that one, because I could cause a sensation by saying, you know, the former tough guy has now turned into a pussycat and so on. And I don't want to lightly do that. I would say rationally, when something is not working, then you stop doing it. And this isn't working. So on the one hand, I'm saying, yes, maybe they should be lifted now. But on the other hand, I am deeply suspicious of two things. One, that would produce any benefit for the ordinary Iraqi people. I strongly suspect that Saddam would simply pocket that and say, good, sanctions are now lifted, we must get back to rebuilding the nation, which would mean the army. Right? And I think that's a real problem. And secondly, Iraq is presently saying, if you first lift sanctions, we will re-accept some monitoring of our weapons industry. But I'm not a card player, but it sounds to me like a potential three-card trick here. I would not rule out a situation where we lifted sanctions and he then said, you know, we've changed our mind about the back end of the proposition where we will now accept new arms controls. You see, because, you remember, you weren't listening. We told you before. We told Butler 2 years ago, we don't have any more weapons, okay? So let's just go on with a normal life. And then that crisis of global security would have been made worse in a way. The Security Council's authority would have been absolutely trashed. He would be getting on with his weapons programs. So what sense could we make of all of that? You can see, Jane, it's a real problem. I don't actually know the answer to it. My gut tells me that if something's not working, then you stop doing it. But what I'm also saying is if we stop doing it, the consequences of it might be not what we had in mind at all, especially for the poor Iraqi people. I would be stunned if their standard of life improved any time soon, quite frankly.
I will leave you with the last question, which I believe to be rhetorical, but it just gives you a sense of the level of support in this room for the work you've done. And the question is, how can we help you prevent the bad guys from doing the wrong thing. Our thanks to Ambassador Richard Butler, author of The Greatest Threat, Iraq. Richard Butler is the author of The Greatest Threat, Iraq, Weapons of Mass Destruction, and the Crisis of Global Security. We want to thank him, and we want to thank you for participating here in San Francisco and for our audience for listening on the radio as well. This meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California and the World Affairs Council of Northern California is now adjourned.